Calling herself the people's champion, Hillary Clinton says she's hitting the road to earn your votes. Good Monday morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross. Hope you had a great weekend out there. Start your mornings with First Coast Connect every weekday at 9, live on the radio. Or if you miss a show, just download our podcast on iTunes. Just ahead, we've got a look at the presidential race. It's just around the corner. In fact, it's already here. And also why Florida will be important once again in 2016. Get on the line now with your thoughts at 549-2937. Then later, from Clinton to Bush, Neil Bush, that is. We'll speak with the chairman of the Points of Light Foundation as he comes to town. Plus, Culpepper on a thrilling Masters tournament in Augusta. All of that and more ahead this hour. But first this morning, with a two-minute video release on Sunday afternoon, Hillary Rodham Clinton announced she's running for president next year. Take a listen.
Americans have fought their way back from tough economic times, but the deck is still stacked in favor of those at the top. Everyday Americans need a champion, and I want to be that champion. So you can do more than just get by. You can get ahead and stay ahead. Because when families are strong, America is strong. So I'm hitting the road to earn your vote, because it's your time. And I hope you'll join me on this journey.
With this video release, Clinton is working to immediately establish herself as the likely Democratic nominee next year. And the video's message sounded themes of economic populism, Clinton saying she'd champion what she calls everyday Americans who've been left out of the economic recovery. A recent poll shows Hillary Clinton would run competitively in Florida against either Jeb Bush or Marco Rubio, both of whom are expected to seek the Republican nomination for president in 2016. So we begin the hour with a look ahead to the race and Florida's strategic importance. Joining us with his thoughts, A.G. Gankarski of Florida Politics. Good morning.
Good morning.
And here's our question to callers. Who will get your vote for president next year? Hillary Clinton, Jeb Bush, Marco Rubio, or someone else? We want to hear right now your thoughts about the 2016 presidential race and how Florida will play a role. Give us a call at 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online to wjctnews.org/firstcoastconnect and email and tweet the show. Two-minute video release, obviously done to control the message. What did you think of the message, AG?
Well, it was a very slick, polished video. You know, I was hearing it was coming out at noon. It actually came out at 3 o'clock on Sunday, which was interesting for political reporters who might have been covering the event, gave them a few hours to just chill and wait. You know, the presentation was light years ahead of anything that's come out from the Republicans, but it was also kind of a well-worn message. You saw sort of the target demographic that Hillary was trying to reach in the video. You know, women, you know, young families, people like that. She posits herself as the liberal fighter for values, you know, for fighting for ordinary working Americans. And, you know, Republicans are going to say, well, look at her. She's got the Clinton Foundation. Bill Clinton's gotten more in speaking fees than any ex-president ever. There's an incongruity in that message. And I think the Republicans are going to be able to exploit that a little bit. But the launch was a success, although I think it's getting picked apart on Twitter even as we speak.
549-2937. In our social media age, of course, anything a candidate does is immediately going to be analyzed and picked apart on a variety of platforms. What about this theme of economic populism? She hit hard on themes of economic inequality and what she called everyday Americans. We're hearing those sort of populist tones from the Republican side, too. For example, former Florida Governor Jeb Bush is having putting together a campaign called Right to Rise.
Right. And he's actually capped out his contributions on that. He wants to make sure not over $1 million or something like that. And really, with these big pocketed campaigns, it's estimated that Hillary's going to have $2 billion at her disposal if she gets through the entire campaign. Jeb Bush, same kind of situation. You know, it does seem a little bit, you know, hilarious for them to be hitting these particular economic populism themes. I think for Hillary hitting them, it's a way of warding off Elizabeth Warren on her left. Elizabeth Warren has talked very consistently throughout her career, both in the Senate before, about economic populism, about the need to, you know, right the wrongs of the last 30 years. I think Hillary Clinton is trying to position herself as, you know, taking the air out of that side. Well, Democratic primary voters find it credible? Will caucus attendees find it credible? Those are the questions that have to resolve themselves.
And we'll go to your calls in just a moment. Let us know your thoughts on Hillary Clinton's entry into the 2016 presidential race and who'll get your vote if you're looking at the field. 549-2937. Now, you mentioned the Clinton Foundation. Hillary Clinton has cut all ties with the Clinton Foundation.
Right.
Another likely presidential candidate, Rand Paul, just yesterday said that Hillary Clinton is compromised as a candidate because the Clinton Foundation has accepted money from countries like Saudi Arabia and other nations with a terrible record on women's rights.
Right. And, you know, really, if you look at a candidate like Hillary Clinton with those kind of ties, you could say the same thing about Jeb Bush, because the Bush family, of course, has lots of ties with the Saudis. They're well documented over the decades. You know, the reality is if you hit that level in international politics, you're going to have international ties, which include with countries that have less than savory human rights records. You know, Rand Paul is going to make his points, but Rand Paul's got his own existential problem, which is that the Republican establishment can't handle his foreign policy. So he'll be used sort of in that Pat Buchanan role to, you know, serve up red meat when it's convenient to the party establishment. But he's not going to be a factor when it gets down to Iowa, New Hampshire, and, you know, Super Tuesday and all these other primaries.
And let's talk not just about Iowa, but Florida.
Okay.
The polling shows Hillary Clinton running very competitively here against two homegrown Florida candidates, Jeb Bush or Marco Rubio. Of course, Florida will be incredibly important in terms of its electoral votes, and it's on a razor's edge in terms of whether it will tilt red or blue. What are your thoughts about their ground game on both sides here in Florida?
Well, we haven't really seen it yet. It's all very preliminary, and these candidates are ultimately hypotheticals right now. And, I mean, we saw the Charlie Crist launch for governor a couple of years ago, where Charlie Crist came out of the gates looking very strong. He looked unbeatable. And Rick Scott, you know, week after week, month after month, chipped away at Charlie Crist's impregnable ledge. I think there's sort of a familiarity that people resonate with. You know, that resonates with the people in Hillary Clinton. I think people remember the 90s, don't stop thinking about tomorrow, all those other things. And there's a nostalgic thing. But what happens when Hillary Clinton is giving speeches again and again? What happens when she's answering the tough questions from reporters? You know, that, say, Marco Rubio's been answering already, that Jeb Bush has, you know, been answering some of them. He'll answer some more. You know, so it's really going to be a question of, you know, how the message wears over a long period of time. You know, the initial launch is very favorable, but, you know, is that as good as it gets for her? That's the open question.
She's also the only candidate so far who's actually run for president before.
Right. And, you know, we saw in that 2008 campaign where a lot of people were coronating her 2 years out. Oh, Hillary Clinton's going to have in 2008. Then we saw Barack Obama emerge. But even if you look at that campaign, people, you know, kind of had Hillary fatigue pretty early on in it. When they got to June and Puerto Rico's primary and Hillary's still fighting, people are just like, when is this going to end? And I think we're seeing that perhaps manifesting again. I mean, what happens when we get a year of Hillary Clinton giving the same speech, using the same themes? You know, it's going to wear thin, I think. So, you know, it's a nice launch, but where does she go from here? That's the real question.
Is she the inevitable nominee? On her side, there's really no one else emerging yet. But on the Republican side, we've got a really interesting scrum going on. As you've got Ted Cruz, probably Rick Santorum again, Mike Huckabee, all expected to split the evangelical vote.
Right.
Then you've got Rand Paul, Jeb Bush, Marco Rubio, and Scott Walker, the governor of Wisconsin. It's a crowded field there.
Right. And, you know, what we see with those fields where you get more than seven plausible candidates, so they start to winnow themselves out. The fundraising isn't there for everybody. The organization isn't there. The right talent isn't there. So you'll see a couple of these people, you know, fall by the wayside. You know, And the issue on the Democratic side is that, yeah, Hillary looks to be a titan in the midst of a bunch of pygmies. Jim Webb, Martin O'Malley, you know, Elizabeth Warren looks semi-plausible. She launches. But, you know, if Hillary waltzes through a primary and caucus process without, you know, taking any hits, is she going to be ready for the general election? That's the question. I mean, when you're running in a bruising sort of primary process, you get battle tested. And, you know, Hillary Clinton hasn't run for anything in 8 years. And, you know, they want a coordinator on the Democratic side. You saw Debbie Wasserman Schultz basically crowning her on social media yesterday, immediately after that video ran. And you're going to see a lot of that. But, you know, when you do that with the candidate and don't actually subject them to the rigors of the primary process and negotiations, then, you know, real questions emerge.
So you think she needs a really strong, tough primary, which she may not get, whereas the Republicans, they will definitely put through their paces.
Yeah, I think it helps to actually have those debates, to have meaningful discussions with voters. You do not want your electorate to get complacent. You want your street team to rehearse in these processes. So there's definitely an advantage to having a contested primary.
And we want your calls right now. The 2016 presidential race, I know it seems early, but it's officially underway. Give us a call with your thoughts. 549-2937. Atticus in San Marco. Hi, Atticus. Good morning.
Good morning. I have never been more encouraged in my life as a resident in Jacksonville, Florida, knowing that she's going to run. Thank you so much. I would tell her to consider her safety. I mean, the far-right Tea Party Republican types, they shot Lincoln, King, Kennedy, Lennon, Milk. But secondly, I would ask her, would she consider putting together a small task force to find the votes that were lost in my lifetime in Jacksonville, Florida, Duval 2000. But she needs to remember that happened. Thank you.
That's Atticus in San Marco.
Those are interesting points. I think something that Hillary is going to deal with throughout this campaign is, without pressure to run to the left, she's going to run more to the center. You're not going to see things like mentioning the 2000 vote from her.
You know what, though? Let me jump in. This video seemed to me, as a centrist Democrat, which she's long been, a pretty hawkish one. On domestic themes, she seems to be tacking a little bit more to the left with this sort of populist messaging that we saw in the video.
Right, but it's so nonspecific. I mean, it's easy to use the tropes and the music and the shots of, you know, happy people doing happy things, as the video did. But, you know, the policy specifics are things like a living wage, like, you know, gender wage equity. These are the issues that, you know, mobilize Democratic activists. You know, regarding what the caller said about her being at risk from the Tea Party right, I don't know if that's true, because she's been a really centrist presence. I mean, we've seen her as Secretary of State, and she's run a foreign policy that was not really that distinct from second-term Bush. She was a steward of, you know, centrist bipartisan foreign policy. So I don't know if it's not 1992 anymore. Hillary Clinton is not an avatar of, you know, progressive thought. Hillary Clinton is very much an embodiment of the establishment.
At the same time, her record as a Secretary of State is certain to be fodder for a slew of campaign ads and attack ads, Benghazi in particular.
I've heard of Benghazi. Yeah, that's going to be brought up some, but, you know, I don't know how much currency that's really going to have, because it can only be mentioned so many times. I was hearing Lindsey Graham and other Republicans on the talk shows yesterday mentioning Benghazi, and it feels like a lifetime ago. And I know there are some Republicans out there who are going to disagree, but, you know, it's like bringing up Mission Accomplished or George W. Bush or something like that. You know, you're just hitting the bell over and over again, trying to get that conditioned response, and you're getting diminishing returns on it. So I think Republicans are going to have to find another trope.
549-2937. Let's go to Tricia in St. Augustine this morning. Hi, Tricia. How are things down your way?
Yes, hi. Good morning, Melissa. I'm a New England transplant and Democrat. And I definitely will vote Democratic, but I'm a huge Elizabeth Warren fan. I think her economic policies and just such a strong commitment to middle class and all of those things that she talks about I understand you're saying that Hillary's trying to sort of take the wind out of that, but I would love it if Elizabeth Warren ran, and I feel like that Hillary has a lot of skeletons and some that are not so hidden, but like you said, Benghazi, but even her earlier years in the law firm and sort of a number of things that sort of mar her history, they're all going to come out. And I want a Democrat to win, but I just love Elizabeth Warren. So I guess that's my point.
Thank you, Tricia. Tricia in St. Augustine. And Senator Elizabeth Warren, of course, the Democrat from Massachusetts, has been on a populist crusade on income inequality, in particular in Wall Street. Liberal Democrats desperately want her to run. She has repeatedly said she's not running. I think it's fair to say that her growing popularity has influenced the rest of the Democratic field with this type of messaging.
Oh, yeah. It definitely has. And you know, you look at where the Democrats were in 2008, you know, there was very aspirational rhetoric associated with the Obama campaign, hope and change. They tried to boil all the hope out of me, you know, he kept saying on the campaign trail. And then he goes to Washington, he runs a very, you know, mildly left of center administration for two terms. So there are Democrats who want a little bit more. They want that sort of economic activism. They want sort of that return to the fighting liberal motif, which is what the Hillary announcement video basically embodied. But, you know, Hillary Clinton, she's a Washington veteran at this point. She's got very well-established positions. And if she's going to evolve on positions, she's going to have to explain it. So she can make rhetorical, concessions to the activist left. But in terms of policy, that's a really open question right now.
Eric on the West Side. Hey, Eric, thanks for holding. What are your thoughts?
Just real quick, I also want Elizabeth Warren to run. I don't think Hillary Clinton is a very good candidate. And the other thing is that, you know, what gets lost in all the discussing about political tactics is who's right and who's wrong. What's the right and wrong of it? And it's obvious that stagnant wages, America has changed from a place in which the middle class was growing, the wealthy paid their taxes, and poverty was being extinguished all the way up until the mid-70s, say. That's changed since then. America has changed. So the question is, who's right and who's wrong? Is a growing middle class, a country in which the wealthy have to pay their taxes and bring back unions, is that right? Or is it right to continue to try to deny working people insurance, access to the healthcare system, a living wage, and for the wealthy to pay their taxes? Who's right and who's wrong? Forget about the tactics of it. Who's right? And that is really the only question in the upcoming election is, where do you stand on the issue of making the wealthy pay their taxes, raising the minimum wage, and bringing back the unions? And thanks for taking my call.
That's Eric on the West Side. We're getting a lot of calls about this. And AG, not only will Hillary Clinton sound these themes, as we talked about a moment ago, the Republicans will too. But their message, their argument is that we can reduce inequality, but our way. We will do it through the private sector. Is that a message that will resonate with voters like Eric?
It's not going to resonate with voters like Eric. I think they've heard the trickle-down economics, sort of Reagan economics, position for 35 years. I don't think that's going to play with them necessarily. The question is, are they going to get what they want from the Democratic Party? If you go back to the last contested race, 2008, you saw Wall Street contributions dramatically going in the direction of the Democratic ticket, the Obama-Biden ticket, as opposed to the Republican side. You know, Democrats see corporations, they see corporate money, banking money, all of that as being very much in play. And they're not going to give you some sort of, you know, socialist light message when they realize that to make the fundraising happen,
they need Wall Street.
They need Wall Street, and Wall Street needs them.
And the only the only political figure of note in this country who's really been a foe of Wall Street is Elizabeth Warren.
Right, which kind of tells you, you know, how the political discourse is stacked.
Yeah.
You know, any administration that comes in from the Democratic or Republican side is going to be stacked, you know, from floor to ceiling with Wall Street types, with people who've been investment bankers, hedge fund bankers, you know, and so forth. So, you know, it's very hard to see, you know, true economic populism emerging from, you know, the candidates who are declared right now or about to declare.
Let's go down to Ray in Orange Park. Hi, Ray. How are you?
Good morning, Melissa. Thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to make a point that politics is the game of redirecting attention, and especially red herring. And I think as enlightened media, as you guys are, your contribution can be to point to the trivia. And I take two examples. One is the comment about Hillary Clinton's nomination being tainted because she's the Clinton Foundation got money from Saudi Arabia. Well, the Saudi Arabia record on women rights may be abhorrent to us, but according to Islamic law, it's perfect. So it's really a question of Islamic law, and maybe that's to be condemned. But to taint an entire country because they're following a particular brand of ideology, and then tie that to a husband through a foundation, and then say that she is somehow tainted. If that's true, then every Republican is tainted because they take money from corporations that pillage and rape countries. The second is the Benghazi. If, as the Secretary of State, she is responsible for what happens on the ground in Benghazi, then far more responsible is the Congress who appropriate the funding for security of Benghazi, or actually cut the funding for security of Benghazi. And I think that politicians use these ploys to detract from the main point. And I, for one, believe it's high time we have a competent woman as a president, and I think it will do all of us well to follow her lead. And I applaud her for it, and I think we should get the Republicans to talk about some sensitive issues rather than try to detract us from talking about the real issues, the wages, the inequality that's happening, the fact that as honest working people, my company is squeezing $2 an hour out of me, but my CEO takes home $25 million packages. So where is the fairness? And I know people talk about them paying taxes. I guarantee you my company doesn't pay any taxes. They find so many loopholes. They pay almost zero taxes. And yet I have no loopholes. I have to pay, even with my meager income, I have to pay my fair share. And I'm happy to do it, but the rich don't. They get richer, and my CEO is a perfect example. And I think those are some.
Ray, what's your Ray? What company do you work for? Can you tell us?
Well, I don't want to. say
okay.
That,
okay. Well, thanks for the call. Thanks for the call, Ray. Ray in Orange Park.
That was interesting. I would point out that, you know, when we get arguments with that many particular tangents, it's very hard for political operatives to make them. He went from one point to another.
But you know what, though? All of these callers are kind of touching on the same complaints, the same anxieties.
Right.
Interesting, isn't it?
It definitely is. And that's Elizabeth Warren's place in the marketplace should she jump in. But, you know, she doesn't seem inclined to jump in.
Right, right. Don on the South Side. Hi, Don. Good morning.
Hi. Morning. In regard to your last caller, I have a similar, you know, everybody's going off on Hillary's financing. George H.W. Bush is part of the Carlyle Group. Also, Bin Laden's brother is part of the Carlyle Group. Why can't we as Democrats bring up where money came from with the Bushes? You know, it's like we have such short memories.
Thanks,
that's
Don.
That's it.
Yeah.
Just like a comment on that.
Yeah, sure. Thanks for the call.
You know, the irony of setting up meaningful distinctions between the Bushes and the Clintons is that the Bushes and the Clinton families have been very close in the last decade or so. Bill Clinton is basically an honorary son of Bush 41 at this point.
Right, right.
So, you know, to talk about their ties, you know, both sides have the same ties.
And what about the argument, too, that perhaps the electorate next year will say, well, you know what? Maybe we don't need another Bush or a Clinton in the White House. Maybe it's time for some new blood. That could easily happen, too.
Well, that discussion would happen in the Iowa caucus. It would happen in New Hampshire primaries. I mean, we've seen it before. Look at 1968. That's before your time, but it's around my time. When
No, it is not.
Eugene McCarthy went up there and shocked Lyndon Johnson. So things do happen to upset the forecast trajectory of events. It's just a question of, you know, trying to forecast where that money's going to come in. We've got an operation like that of Hillary Clinton or Jeb Bush or, you know, anybody along those lines. You've got to consider, you know, you're going to need $1 billion. You're going to need a lot of ground troops. You're going to need real enthusiasm, the ability to manufacture more enthusiasm. And, you know, these are all logistical things that political operatives work on for a lot longer than a year and a half or so. You know, they take, you know, 4 years, 8 years to lay the groundwork, and I don't see it out there right now.
We'll continue to follow it, but obviously the interest is already high. As always, great to see you. Thanks for being on the show.
Thank you for having me.
A.G. Gankarski of Florida Politics and Folio Weekly joining us this morning. And much more still ahead. Later, Culpepper recaps a thrilling Masters up in Augusta. But up next, a conversation with Neil Bush of the Points of Light Foundation as he visits Jacksonville. That's after this.
WJCTnews.org is your source for the latest local, national, and international news 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Podcasts of your favorite local stories and shows, the WJCT First Read every weekday morning, and playlists from all of our after-hours music programming. From your computer or mobile device, see it all at WJCTnews.org.
Relax around the clock with the music of your life. Playing great music from Frank Sinatra and Ella Fitzgerald to James Taylor, Joni Mitchell, and more. Relax Radio, WJCT, 89.9 HD3. Learn more at wjct.org/relax.
Never know how much I love you.
Wherever you spend your morning, NPR's Morning Edition is there with you. Wherever the story takes place, NPR's Morning Edition connects it with you.
Dallas.
Des Moines.
Topeka.
Montana.
Cleveland.
San Francisco.
Denver.
Philadelphia.
Minneapolis.
Miami.
Colorado.
Washington.
You will own your morning, wherever you are, when you choose to spend tomorrow with Morning Edition from NPR News. Weekday mornings beginning at 5 on 89.9 WJCT, community-supported public radio.
Welcome back. Well, he's the son and the brother of two U.S. presidents. Neil Bush is also board chairman of the Points of Light Foundation, and Bush is coming to town this month for a special event as Hands on Jacksonville hosts Celebrate Good. It's happening in April during National Volunteer Week, Florida Volunteer Month, and Jacksonville Volunteer Appreciation Month. The idea is to honor the good deeds people do every day on the First Coast. On the line, we're pleased to welcome Neil Bush. Neil, good morning.
Good morning to you. How are you?
I'm great. So good to have you on the show. And here in studio, Judy Smith, President and CEO of Hands on Jacksonville.
It's great to be here.
Hey, Judy.
Melissa.
And Jefferson Rawl of Anton West Advertising, also doing some work around the event. Good morning to you.
Good morning. Thank you.
Neil Bush, let's begin with you. I remember very well when your father made his famous Points of Light speech. And of course, that led to the creation of the Points of Light Foundation. So much good has been done in the ensuing years. For those that aren't familiar, though, with the foundation, can you tell us about the good work that you do?
Sure. First of all, I appreciate your bringing up dads using the phrase Points of Light. The words Points of Light, I think, inspires us all to try to find the light in us. And everyone has a light that resides in our heart to serve others. And when Dad talked about it during his presidency and during the campaign leading up to his election, there were about 30 million Americans serving, volunteering in some capacity during the year. Now 65 million Americans serve. And it's been exciting. Points of Light, the organization, is the largest organization in the world focused on volunteerism and service. And we have many, many functions to kind of help be a catalyst for promoting service around the world. Part of what we do is to support an organization of volunteer centers around the country, and Jacksonville is blessed to have an outstanding organization, which will be, as you mentioned, celebrating the Celebrate Good celebration April 27th. I'm excited to come to town to support their good work. We try to herd these 250 volunteer centers to share best practices. We've developed a technology platform that they can use for volunteer management, and there are other benefits. But I'm very excited that the volunteer service movement through corporate America, through young people, through the volunteer centers we work with is growing, and it needs to grow. And then I'll make one final statement, I'm dominating, but we have problems that persist in our country. We have poverty in my city of Houston, and I imagine in Jacksonville, is seemingly intractable. Government isn't solving the problem, so people need to roll up their sleeves and to work collaboratively and through coalitions, but to work as volunteers, as points of light in their community to help lift their fellow man. We cannot rely on government to do this, and so I'm proud of Dad's legacy in promoting service. He said any life, any successful life must be defined by serving others.
And so that brings us to Judy Smith of Hands On Jacksonville. You're bringing Mr. Bush to town for this special event coming up Monday, April 27th. Celebrate Good.
Yes, absolutely. We're thrilled that Neil is going to join us. He has been such a moving force for the Points of Light over the years, particularly after the merger with the Hands On Network. So we became the Points of Light and Hands On Network. And that gives us such a so much larger a presence, having that backing of a national organization. You know, I want to share with you, with the listeners, I really would like to share this, the actual words from President Bush. In his inaugural address, what he said was, "I have spoken of 1,000 points of light of all the community organizations that are spread like stars throughout the nation doing good. We will work hand in hand, encouraging, sometimes leading, sometimes being led, rewarding. We will work on this in the White House, in the cabinet agencies. I will go to the people and the programs that are the brighter points of light, and I will ask every member of my government to become involved. The old ideas are new again because they are not old. They are timeless. Duty, sacrifice, commitment, and a patriotism that finds its expression in taking part and pitching in." And that's what Celebrate Good is all about. We want to celebrate the thousands of volunteers in Jacksonville, because Jacksonville is a volunteering town.
It really is. Jefferson Raw, let's bring you in, Executive Creative Director of Anton West Advertising. You're donating all your services to this event, right?
Yes. We have... you know, in the agency's past, we've talked about how we would do some kind of pro bono work. How can we help the community? And this came up as a great opportunity because we are working with them as a full-time client. So this isn't a one and done. We got the festival going. Let's work on their brand. Let's work on their communications. Let's help them. And so we've caught on to Judy's volunteer spirit, as she's just mentioned. And we want to be one of those points of light. And so we decided to dive into this as a volunteer. And we've asked a lot of our partners, broadcast partners, creative partners to do it with us, and they've done it full force. So we're excited to be a part of it.
Very exciting. And Neil Bush, you've made such a mark with Points of Light, the world's largest organization dedicated to volunteer service. As you said a minute ago, we can't only rely on government to solve some of these problems. But of course, since you're on the line, I have to ask you, your brother Jeb Bush is looking probably to run for president pretty soon. Florida is very important. What are your thoughts about the race?
First of all, you should know, and your listeners should know, I'm the least political member of this very famous political family.
Uh-huh.
I'm not really But I'm very, very proud of Jeb, and it's going to be a very competitive race. You know, if you want to know what a guy is capable of doing, just, you know, look at his track record. And I think he had an extraordinary track record leading the state of Florida. So his credentials are clear, passionate about issues. And, you know, he's been kind of raised in a family where the culture of service prevails. He's chosen a political route. I've chosen kind of a nonprofit route. But it's to the same end, to try to make the world a better place and to try to help lift individuals to realize their fullest potential. And I think Jeb's Right to Rise PAC, the name of it alone says it all. We need to help people realize their right to rise. And so volunteerism and service, it all goes hand in hand. And anyway, I'm proud of Jeb. I think he's got a good shot. I know he's lean and mean and running hard, and not running hard, but looking at it hard. And if he runs, he'll run hard. So I'm very proud of him.
All right. Well, Neil Bush, it's a pleasure to have you on the program. I hope you enjoy your time in Florida. Neil Bush, the keynote speaker at Celebrate Good, the VIP event and speech and dinner coming up Monday, April 27th at Unity Plaza, 220 Riverside. Tickets at handsonjacksonville.org, right?
That's it.
All right. Neil Bush, Judy Smith, Jefferson Rawl, thanks so much for being with us. We appreciate it.
Our pleasure.
Thank you,
Melissa.
And still, thank you so much. And still to come, sports with Cole. Also a preview of Spring for the Arts. We're back in a moment.
William Bartram's Travels is a classic book documenting the flora, fauna, and native people of 18th century Florida. I'm Ben Brotmarkle, and coming up on Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, we'll talk with J.D. Sutton about his one-man show depicting Bartram to be performed at Lou Botanical Gardens in Orlando. Also, papers from the American Revolution and turpentine labor camps on Florida Frontiers, Monday evening at 6:30 on 89.9 WJCT.
The Dinosaur Train is rolling into Orange Park. Thrasher Horn Center and WJCT present Jim Henson's Dinosaur Train Live, Buddy's Big Adventure, on Tuesday, May 12 at 6 p.m. See the beloved stars of the hit PBS series come to life on stage in your hometown for the first time. Join Buddy, Tiny, King, Don, and their family and friends in this fun-filled, interactive musical trip back in time. Tickets are on sale now at 904-276-6815 or thcenter.org.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the 2016 presidential campaign is starting to take shape as more candidates throw their hats into the ring, analysis of major policy issues, and how the race could play out.
Weekdays at 10, right after First Coast Connect on 89.9 FM WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, hundreds of supporters will get together this Friday to support a great cause, Spring for the Arts. The 11th annual event from the Cathedral Arts Project is raising money to enrich the quality of life in our area through unleashing the creative spirit of our young people. CAP Kids provides access to instruction in the visual and performing arts, and it empowers underserved school-aged children to succeed. Here with a preview, Beth Jennison, event chair for Spring for the Arts. Good morning.
Thank you, and thank you so much for having us this morning. We really appreciate it.
Oh, certainly. We also have with us Heather Moore Garrity, presenting sponsor for the event.
Hi, Melissa. Thank you for having me on the show.
I so appreciate you being with us, both of you. In a moment, I want to ask you about this new initiative called Curating Confidence.
Thank you.
But first, for people that have never heard of Spring for the Arts, Beth, this is a really fun an exciting event, and it's a great cause. Tell us about it.
Yes, it is a really fun event for a great cause. It's this Friday night at 6:30 at the Deerwood Country Club. You can get tickets at the door. You can also get tickets online. Go to capkids.org, and we have fine wine, gourmet food. The children will be there, some of our CAP kids performing. They'll have a chorus there. We'll view some of their art, and we'll have beautiful flowers. It's just a wonderful event, and everyone looks forward to it, and we hope to that everyone will try to attend.
And what I love about Cathedral Arts is it started some 20 years ago at the local St. John's Episcopal Cathedral. They wanted to bring arts education to kids that weren't getting it in the public schools. They started small, but within just a few years, they were providing classes to children all over Duval County.
Yes,
Heather, it's a really neat success story.
It is. It's a great success story. We've provided quality curriculum-based arts education for over 20 years with our ongoing programs. And now we're about to launch a new program, Curating Confidence. And I have to give credit because the idea for Curating Confidence was inspired by an NPR program.
Oh,
so
which
I had one?
One
of those driveway moments. I don't know exactly which one it was, but I was sitting there in my driveway listening about this story that this woman had done. And I said, you know, we could do that here for Cathedral Arts Project. And so that's what we're starting. And it's all based on the idea that on a basic level, everyone wants to be given validation for a job well done, not just from their peers, but from people outside their circle of influence. And Curating Confidence is going to do just that. It's a year-round initiative designed to foster self-confidence through supporter recognition of our students. We've chosen a select number of students' artwork and transformed them into this large-scale format to have the most impact. And I believe that they would have an impact in any environment. But what we're doing and our main goal is to get them back into the schools of the students who created them. I think that it's a great way to foster self-confidence when our young artist enters his or her school, looks up, and sees this large-scale reproduction hanging prominently in the entranceway. And it's going to be a powerful statement to the student and for the young child to witness, and it will instill and inspire confidence.
Very nice. And you know, Beth, arts education, there's a wealth of data to show that art and music education has a hugely positive impact on children. But unfortunately, those are often the first programs that get cut when the budget is lean. Cathedral Arts has really filled a need for
Yes.
so many children, hasn't it?
It really has. It and these art programs, studies have been shown they improve their grades, their school attendance, they improve their behavior, even graduating to the next grade level, and they've been shown to excel on standardized testing. It's very important, and I do feel that Cathedral Arts has been able to fulfill a need that is lacking now.
And so it's not too late to get your tickets then
yes.
for Friday night. How can people get their tickets?
Get the tickets at capkids.org online, or you may buy one at the door. So we welcome everyone. Please join us. It's a wonderful celebration.
Well, it's going to be a wonderful event. And thank you so much, Event Chair Beth Jennison, sponsor Heather Moore Garrity. Again, it's the 11th annual Spring for the Arts this Friday at the Deerwood Country Club, supporting arts education for our kids. Have a great time.
Thank you so
and
much.
And thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And finally, this hour, a dominant and historic performance by the new Masters champion.
I'm a pepper, he's a pepper, she's a pepper, we're a pepper, wouldn't you like to be a pepper too?
Cole Pepper here now to tell us about the triumph of Jordan Spieth and the rest of the weekend sports and talk barbecue, too. Hey, Cole.
Hello. What a performance it was by Jordan Spieth, who led wire to wire. He became the first guy to do that since Sansevieria slacks were in vogue in Raymond Floyd's era, 1976. And at the age of 21 and a few months, he was 5 months older than Tiger Woods, second youngest winner in the history of the Masters Tournament. And listen to some of these other records that he set along the way. Lowest 36-hole score, lowest 54-hole score, tied for the lowest 72-hole score. He was at 18-under par, matching Tiger. He was the first to ever be at 19-under par at any point in a Masters before he bogeyed 18. Most birdies in a Masters tournament. Just a spectacular performance for a guy who, if he had stayed in college, would be graduating this month.
Right.
Instead, here he is, as I thought it was a nice line on, he didn't get his undergrad, but now he's got his master's.
Yes, he does. And the green jacket, too.
The green jacket to go with it. And remember, last year he was in contention in his first master's at the age of 20. He has played 8 rounds at Augusta National and has been in contention at the end of each and every one of them, and wow, including leading all the way here in 2015.
Pretty exciting. And you said he's the second youngest winner. Was Tiger Woods
Tiger
the youngest?
Woods was yeah. the youngest yeah. by about 5 months back in 97. And remember, when Tiger won, that sort of started the trend of tiger-proofing golf courses. Augusta National was one of them that became a much longer golf course. They had to try to tiger-proof it. Didn't work, as it turned out. Jordan Spieth is a different kind of golfer than Tiger Woods. Tiger would intimidate with in his young days with distance and intensity, whereas Spieth is kind of an old-school player. Plays down the middle, steady, straight, and his mentality and his demeanor on the course is very steady and straight as well. So I think we're going to see a lot of Jordan Spieth down the line. Remember, last year at the Players' Championship, Spieth was in contention as well, just couldn't close it out late. Now he's going to come in as a major champion in 3 weeks when the Players gets going down at TPC Sawgrass. And he's also now the world's number 2 ranked player behind Rory McIlroy. So you have those two young golfers who might provide the rivalry in golf for the next 5, 10, 15 years.
We'll have to watch it. And as you said, the Players is just around the corner. So is the NFL draft. My gosh.
Just 17 days away now, and the Jaguars brass were in Gainesville on Tuesday checking out Dante Fowler Jr. and 19 other Florida players. It's an important draft for the Jaguars brass. Clearly, they have to find some folks who can make a difference in the long term, but I think they also need to find some rookies who can contribute this year, not just developmental guys, but guys who can make a difference right now. They made some additions in free agency that should help the team, but for general manager Dave Caldwell and head coach Gus Bradley, they have to show notable improvement this year. I don't think they have to make the playoffs, but if they don't contend, look competitive, win some games, I think there's going to be some calls for change at really? The end of 2015.
You think even that all they have to do is just win a few, they don't even have to be have a playoff berth?
Don't need a playoff berth, but I think I would use this as the litmus test. If at Thanksgiving dinner you're talking about how the Jaguars could make the playoffs, not necessarily if they were a favorite, but if you're saying, well, you know, it could happen if this, and this happened, it would be a step forward. They could even be at that point, you know, a 5-7 football team, but still have the opportunity to close. And so it's been too long since the Jaguars mattered in terms of the conversation around Thanksgiving
sure.
or later.
Well, we'll have to follow it. Meanwhile, the Armada down in Fort Lauderdale lost Saturday.
Yeah, an emotion-filled match, 2-1 at the Fort Lauderdale Strikers. They called it the Battle for the Atlantic. Mm-hmm. This is a term that was created by the fan bases of both the Strikers and the Armada. It's also the Coastal Cup. It's a three-way competition between Tampa, Fort Lauderdale, and Jacksonville in the league. It's also the sort of the start or maybe the restart of a rivalry that dates back to the team and the Strikers in the old NASL. Those were always very physical battles, including one instance back in 1981 where a guy had over 40 stitches needed after he caught an elbow to the face. Hmm. So this it wasn't quite that, but it did get a little chippy down there, and I think we're going to see that rivalry develop as the Armada's first season rolls on.
And let's move on to the Sharks and the Suns. The Sharks now 0-3.
Yeah, lost to Philadelphia. They returned to the arena Friday in search of their first win of the season against San Jose. The Suns, on the other hand, play today at 12:05. They've won 3 of their first 4 games of the year, including a 4-2 victory over the Jackson Generals yesterday.
Now let's talk about the really important news
now
of the
weekend.
Now
we're getting to it. Yeah.
The barbecue championships that you, of course, are the absolute ringmaster of at Everbank Field. Hundreds of people came out to this thing. What a delicious event it was.
Well, and we thank Karen Fagans, who was among
one
the
of our judges
for the event. And hats off to the pro champions, Tim Thompson's team, Six Guns and Lou, and the backyard team. Great name for the backyard team. Two Smoking Fat Boys, P-H-A-T, fat.
Right off the bat, you sure. know they're going to make good barbecue.
That's right. They win the title of Amateur Barbecue Kings of Jacksonville. 49 teams registered, over 1,000 people attended. Still working on the final numbers, but the event will certainly help us award the Glenn Cook Memorial Scholarships for Daniel Kids for the 7th year in a row here in a few months.
Very nice. And the way that you have run this whole event is just so incredible. You make everyone feel welcome. You bring in some great judges. You've even got a few local celebrities now certified to be barbecue judges. That's actually a thing. There's a whole culture around this.
There really is. And so we have certified judges who judge for the pro teams. But as things have gone on, Nikki Kimbleton at Channel 4, Joe Fortunato from the Jaguars broadcast, Marco Coleman of the Jaguars, have all become certified. Wally Conway, the local radio home improvement guy, have all become certified barbecue judges. And, you know, it's a weekend that takes a little bit of time, a little bit of focus, and some loose-fitting pants.
We're going to have to get Karen Fagan certified.
Yeah, let's do that.
I think that's the next step,
absolutely,
isn't it?
Yeah.
Isn't it? Well, we'll have to wait another year for that. But what a fun time at the football stadium with Cole Pepper. Always great to see you. Have a great week. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks, Melissa.
And follow Cole on Twitter at Cole Pepper. And that's our program. Thanks to all of our guests and callers today. Our producer is Sean Birch. The show theme composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony Orchestra's Pyotr Chevchik. If you have questions or feedback, just drop us a line at firstcoastconnect@wjct.org and make sure to catch our daily podcasts. They're now up on iTunes. Diane Rehm is next. I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT FM Jacksonville. Your community, your world. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.